南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Hello friends, how are you today? I hope this podcast finds you in good health and secure. I know in our world today, those two are, we must appreciate them as luxuries, unfortunately, because there's a lot of craziness in the world today. Anyway, we're going to continue with the Gosho we began the last couple of videos, the Ganjin Honzon Sho, or a treatise revealing the spiritual contemplation and the most venerable one in the fifth 500-year period following Shakyamuni's extinction. And today we're going to focus on the chapter named chapter 3 here, the mutual possession of the 10 realms as revealed in the Lotus Sutra. We've been talking at length about the 3,000 realms or existences. It's labeled differently, not because they're competing ways of interpreting the same thing, although, you know, English being the specificity word construction that it is, we have to remember these were oral teachings and they were taught in Prakrit, a form of layman's Sanskrit, if you will, Pali, Sanskrit, Prakrit, all of these early Indian languages were very conceptual in nature, like a song, like poetry, conceptually heavy. And so a lot of those little connective tissue words of English, not in there. So concepts, when you say in English that something is buttery, you imagine everything from beef tallow to bacon fat to dairy, whether it's margarine or butter itself or clarified butter, all of the things. Even we talk about, you know, playing a guitar as buttery, right? So buttery is kind of a conceptual word. But we have a tendency in English to talk about the unsalted or unsalted dairy butter, and we get very distinct in what we're saying. And so this is an area where translating things into other languages, not just English, this is where things can slide around and seem like very specific, but in actuality are much larger concepts. So I've tried to, as we've talked about the 3,000 realms, or as many of you have studied the 10 worlds, you know, a world has a real a conceptualness to it in the Western mind of a civilized place, a populated by humans place. When we talk about world news or world sports or world whatever, it's something contained in the human experience as a physical reality, right? But in truth, when Buddhism talks about realms or existences or past, present, future, all these things, yet we have to keep in mind always that Buddhism is about the mind, our mental processes. So when we discuss 3,000 existences or 10 realms, we're talking about perceptual, experiential mechanisms of the mind, perceiving encapsulating, labeling, identifying. And this is the crux of Buddhism. What is this identifying thing going on? Because it is in that very identifying. In other words, identifying is the process of dissecting and compartmentalizing manifestations of potential in a certain category, in a certain subcategory, and a certain aspect of that category as a static existing of its own thing. And the identification part isn't about identifying that this clump of plastic and electrons and so forth is a laptop, but it's about identifying it as distinct from me, distinct from I-ness. And that's the ID, identification with. See, identification is, we would think, a labeling of the thing. But in truth, in Buddhism, identification is the labeling of the duality. That is this, not that. That is that, not me. Therefore, I know more about me by identifying that. Do you see the back and forth there, the duality? And therein, Buddhism identifies the crux of all suffering in life, the anxiety, the stress about living, is all about that identification mechanism. The moment I identify something that not only is a thing that I'm making static, which is an illusion, because everything is constantly manifesting and degrading and disappearing, but for a period of time that I construct in my mind, this thing exists. Perhaps not in perpetuity, but for a good long while. And therefore, I see it as the same. But anyone who's owned a computer for a little while, or a phone, knows, a phone is a computer, that the behavior of that machine is constantly changing. And it's getting slower. And it's not holding a charge, whatever. Things are constantly in a flow. There's a momentum to life. It's inescapable. That is the process of life, including you and I, right? So, when we talk about realms or worlds, which I'm going to use less and less, realm, I think, opens up the thought a little bit better than world, or existence for that matter, because that's much closer to experiencing. Yeah? So, realms we can think of as the way the mind shifts in its perspectives, whether writ large, a complete experience of a life, or a day, or an hour, or a minute, or a moment, or moment to moment. And here's where Buddhists focus our attention. Because we understand from the study of Buddhism that our very life itself, the life of the universe, life in its process, is a constantly reinstantiation, a manifestation of potentials. And as it's manifesting potential, it's being influenced. It's collecting more data. It's putting out more data. It's an exchange of energy. And it's constantly going on, moment to moment and moment. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. That cycle. It's like the cycle of a hum. A cycle of a frequency is a cycle, yeah? So, from that spot, let's investigate this chapter, the mutual possession of the ten realms as revealed in the Lotus Sutra. Contrary to what some might say is, you're now in the realm of, that's a nonsensical, ignorant statement, because it fails to realize that in each single thought moment, we are passing through, experiencing, choosing, focusing on, amalgamating from 3,000 existences existing in the mind. Now, it's a much greater number than that if you need to assign a number to it. The number 3,000 is, a conceptual idea that forces us to think that what we are experiencing in samsara, in our physical, earthly mind, right, is just a minor subset of the actual existence that we are experiencing is far larger and more encompassing than what our human mind is contending with by choice, by predilection, by tendency. Do you have a tendency to go this way or that, given the conditions, tendencies and conditions? This is what all of life in the universe is, you could say, ruled by. But what is ruled? What is ruled is the experience, the knowing. And that knowing, that samsaric knowing by the numbers, becomes very obviously a very small, narrow portion of the possibilities that are all laid out before us. So how do we narrow that down? The answer, the karmic momentum that we have built in, the tendencies within conditions ad nauseum, like nesting dolls, right? This is the mind at work. And so Buddhism, or what Siddhartha Gautama discovered when he enlightened the Buddha condition of understanding and seeing all 3,000 existences and realms in each moment, therefore liberating us from those tendencies and conditions, that's one. And by doing that, liberating us from the tendencies and conditions of identification of everything. And so then what we are left with is a crystal clear experience of life, unaffected, uninfluenced, and simply being in it, fully engaged. Something bewilderingly awesome. And a side effect of that engagement is the identification is gone. The latching on, the possession of thingness, the fear of losing it, it just doesn't belong there. That's a byproduct of all these other illusory, minimized tendencies and conditions. Do you see? Let's get to Nichiren. Question. I have learned that the 3,000 existences contained in one thought doctrine was first expounded in the fifth facile of the Great Concentration and Insight, one of the three major works of Grandmaster Tendai. Now, I would like to know the meaning of spiritual contemplation of the 3,000 existences contained in one thought. Answer. Spiritual contemplation means for one to meditate on his own mind. Now, I've said in the past, the word spiritual or spirit in Buddhism isn't about something outside of ourselves, some other being or consciousness or anything like that. Buddhism is about the mind, our attitudes and our intent. Okay? So when he answers Nichiren, and this is a translation, I understand, but these are very high-level translations, people who've studied for decades, right? Language, history, the whole thing. So Nichiren says, spiritual contemplation means for one to meditate on his own mind, observing through it 10 realms, from the hells up to the realm of Buddhas, all of which are by nature contained in every mind. For instance, one can see 6 sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, of other people, but one cannot see and know one's own 6 sense organs unless one sees one's reflection in a clear mirror. Despite the fact that various sutras often preach 6 realms of illusion, the realms of hell, hunger, animal, the lower 6 realms, and the 4 realms of, here it says holy beings, say developed minds, developed Buddhist practice, right? Learning, realization, bodhisattva, Buddhahood. We do not see how our minds contain 10 realms, 100 realms, 1,000 aspects, and 3,000 modes of existence. Modes, interesting word. Unless we see our reflection in the clear mirror of the Lotus Sutra and the writings of Grandmaster Tendai, such as great concentration and insight. So that's quite a mouthful right there. Modes of existence. What is a mode of existence? Well, if your tendencies and conditions are to live life as an ignorant human being, not stupid, but unexposed to and unlearned about mental processes like Buddhism, then one would be firmly identifying a self in relation to one's possessions and desires, right? And so you would wake up every morning overwhelmed by either fears of what the day might bring, history, your past, influenced by those in your environs, including the environment, not just the people, but animals, trees, your home, so on and so forth, and completely mentally consumed by decisions about survival, satiation of hunger, sex, appearance, gaining, manipulating, all the things that humans do in order to get through a day of experience is a mode or several modes of satisfying a perceived need based on hell, hunger, animality, right? Those realms are all readily available to an unenlightened human life, right? And if you wake up incarcerated in a cell, in a jumpsuit, in a jail cell, barely remembering what happened the night before, you might feel a great amount of fear. And in that realm, if you're alone in the cell, you might be very much in the lower realms. Your decisions, your ideas about waking up and how your day is about to proceed will be in a different mode, a different state of mind, mode of survival and being, than if you wake up in a hammock on a desert island or a nice coastline. You don't know you're on an island, and you got palm trees and a ready beverage next to you and a smiling face in front of you. You're going to be in a very different mode of existence. right? A different state of mind. Make sense? And what Buddhism is saying and what he's setting up here, Nichiren is that all the realms, whether you wake up in a cell or on a coastline, a beatific coastline, all the realms are still there at the ready for you to experience. Your state of mind, your modes can change in an instant. You can be in that hammock, wake up, have the pineapple with the umbrella next to you and the smiling, lover, person, human, whatever, service around you, and suddenly see the barrel of a gun and the clicking of an aperture to load it, prepare it for firing, and suddenly you transgress transmutate through several realms immediately to bouncing around in hell, hunger, animality, how do I survive, what do I do, fear, aggression, so on and so forth. That's all happening moment to moment, right? All the modes of existence are constantly at the ready to manifest. Which ones we focus on, choose to act on, that's a complex equation of the momentum and the specific tiny little angstrom moments that you're experiencing, right? So this is where Buddhism's most intense dissection, if you will, of the human experience takes place. Next question. Which part of the Lotus Sutra are you referring to? What does Tendai's explanation of them mean? No small question, right? Answer. The second chapter, so Nichiren is going to take this step by step, right? The second chapter of the Lotus Sutra, the expedient means or skillful means, in Facil 1 states that the purpose of the Buddha's appearing in the worlds was, quote, to cause all living beings to open the gate to the insight of the Buddha, right? Which is the function Nichiren labels Gohonzon. That's not a word he invented. What he's taking is a tradition that goes prior to Buddhism of having an object of focus, a mandala. Remember he said the mirror, the perfect mirror? So we've understood as a species long before Buddhism that if we wanted to deeply experience something, we needed to focus our attention on it. As a human being, if we need to focus our minds, we need all of the input parameters that we have into our brain to feed that emergent thing we call a mind with as much data as possible. And we do that with visual consciousness, oral consciousness, feeling consciousness, taste consciousness, so on and so forth. Yeah? So we integrate all of those senses, and the more of them we can integrate, the stronger our mental focus becomes, right? And that becomes then, it's kind of a trick of taking something that we think of as physical, but it's transmutating just along with everything else. It's momentum, it's energy in a form, right? And what we actually perceive is within our experience of life. We're feeding our mind with this focal point that truly is a focal point in our mind, though we have this device we call a mandala in order to focus all of our senses on it, or at least some of our senses, right? So, the gate, as it were, to the insight of the Buddha, of Buddha-ness, the gate is the Gohanzon. Yeah? The ultimate Hanzon, the ultimate mandala, to represent this gate in our mind. This means that of the 9 of the 10 realms of living beings, excepting the realm of Buddhas, each embraces the realm of Buddhas. So, pardon my interruptions, but in case you didn't get what he was saying there, is that all minds have the 10 realms constantly occurring. But that when we constantly cause all living beings to open the gate to the inside of Buddha, we are opening that Gohanzon, that gate of Buddha, that Buddha-ness, within each of those 10 worlds or 10 realms. This is the interpenetration. And then he goes on to say, in the 16th chapter, the duration of the life of the Tathagata, right? Or the lifespan of the Tathagata, the sutra also declares, as I said before, quote, it is an immeasurably long time since I, Shakyamuni Buddha, obtained Buddhahood. My life spans an innumerably and incalculably long period of time. Nevertheless, I am always here and I shall never pass away. Good men, the duration of my life, and he's speaking now as Buddha-ness, which I obtained by practicing the way of bodhisattvas, me here, Shakyamuni, the man, has not yet expired, because Buddha is not me. Buddha is a state of knowing and experiencing that is always at the ready. It will last twice as long as the length of time as stated above, end quote. This passage also shows that the 9 realms are included in the realm of Buddhas. Oh, back the other way around. That all those 10 realms, which is what we're talking about right now, are also included in the realm of Buddhahood. So how can you ever be in just one realm? That's a fallacy of human categorizing labeling, right? Compartmentalizing. It's just not real. When you're talking about the mind, it's a far more fluid, amorphous, includes all manifestations and all potential manifestations within it. The only reason you're not experiencing that, by the way, Buddha, is because there's a selection process of contrived ideas that's a result of your momentum, your karma. This passage also shows that the 9 realms are included in the 10 realms, or in the realm of Buddhas. The following passage in the Lotus Sutra also shows that the 10 realms of living beings embrace one another. It is said in the 12th chapter, Devadatta, that after an incalculably long period of time, Devadatta will be a Buddha called Heavenly King. This shows the realm of Buddhas included in the realms of hells, as it says, that even a man as wicked as Devadatta, who tried to kill the Buddha or Shakyamuni Buddha, and I wish they would distinguish that in these translations, and had gone to hell, will be able to become a Buddha. So this is he's showing how the very stories, the expedient means of the Lotus Sutra, dissect this whole realms issue. In the 26th chapter, the Dharani's chapter, the Buddha praises the 10 female Rakshasa demons such as Lamba, saying, quote, your merits will be immeasurable even when you protect the person who keeps only the name of the Lotus Sutra, end quote. What is the name of the Lotus Sutra? Myoho Renge Kyo. Since even these Rakshasa demons in the realm of hungry spirits protect the one who practices the Lotus Sutra, the Myoho Rengekyo, the 10 realms, from hells up to the realm of Buddhas, are comprised in the realm of hungry spirits. Because if you are Rakshasa, is by definition one of the demons from the hungry, the state of hunger, insatiable hunger, right? The realm we define as the realm of hungry spirits, you, a Rakshasa, are the figurehead, the conceptual thought that is that very realm. You too are comprised of all the other realms, including Buddha. So interpenetration at a very profound level, right? And remember, we started out by meditating, quote unquote, on one's own mind. And so, apart from chanting, which I call active meditation, simple meditation is a deep consideration of these ideas of how the realms are there, the way, if we have deep enough meditation, the way we can perceive ourselves, even just sitting in meditation, how we are triggering and moving around between certain realms, can be can be really shattering, but it can also be very enlightening. And the reason I distinguish meditation from active meditation or chanting is that when we chant, we have a particular goal in mind. When we meditate, we're simply investigating, digging, uncluttering, trying to experience a human clarity, far, far lesser than Buddha-ness, an ultimate, all-pervasive clarity. But it may be handy to consider and meditate on the nature of our own minds. Just watch it. Just try to watch it. What are you doing now? How am I feeling about it? Oh, that, where was that thought? I just had an errant thought about it. I have an itch. Oh, I'm sitting more on my right butt cheek than my left. My toe just feels twisted. Why am I thinking this way? Why is she in my... I owe so much money. Your mind is just flooded with all sorts of thoughts. Can you slow them down enough to consider what realms you're traveling through as those thoughts go through your head? This isn't how to attain enlightenment, but it is how to get a better grasp on what our life experience is actually constructed from. It can be very humbling, really, ultimately, how little control we have over the way we navigate our own lives. We're just constantly, because then you have to ask yourself, as these floods of thoughts are going through your head, that those thoughts are actions, they are formations, they are form from formation. So what's forming them? Where is that thought coming from? Or better, how? Because that's from karma. That's from tendencies and conditions. So this is an exercise one can do, right? Far different from chanting Namu Myoho Rengekyo. That's an invocation. That's saying, okay, now we're single-mindedly going to do this. We're going to obliterate all that other stuff because it's all delusion. No matter how good a meditator you become, what you're meditating on and what you're experiencing in your mind is from your human momentum, your karma. You're never going to escape it. You're just going to get maybe more adept at seeing it at work. But, you know, as you're sinking in quicksand, you may become an expert in how quicksand works, but you're going to die, right? That's not what we want. What we want is to leave the entire concept of quicksand and that experience aside. That's a very different kind of mental work, yeah? So let's continue. In the 10th chapter, the teacher of the Dharma says that even a demigod like Asura King Balin, a king of Asura demons, Asura, the world of anger, right? Mentioned in the first chapter introduction, will obtain Buddhahood if he rejoices for a moment at hearing a verse or phrase of the Myoho Renge Kyo. This shows that the 10 realms are contained in the realm of the Asura demons. Now remember, in Buddhism, anger, the world of anger, the realm of anger, isn't about, that's in the hell. That's rage. That's that kind of anger. In the West, we think of anger as rage. In Buddhism, the world of anger is manipulation, backstabbing, right? Trying to take advantage of. And we may do it, there's a whole range to that, right? It may be actually a benevolent act that we believe we're supporting, but still the world of anger. Or we want to take advantage and mislead people so that we can have something to gain. It's very egotistical, the world of anger. And boy, if you can't find an example in our world today of the world of anger, you don't understand the world of anger. Okay. So obviously he's going to take apart every single realm and display for you in the Lotus Sutra where it is directly addressed. It is stated in the second chapter, Expedience, that those who carve an image of the Buddha with proper physical characteristics in his honor have already attained the enlightenment of the Buddha, showing that the realm of humans includes the 10 realms. So he's saying that somebody who dedicates with reverence some homage to Buddha, the conditioned Buddha, already has a profound respect for and is working deeply on their own attainment. And that includes human ignorance, all the realms that we are in samsara, default, right? In the third chapter, the Buddha assures Shariputra, the wisest of his Sravaka disciples, that he will also attain Buddhahood in the future life and will be called Kekko, or Flower Light Buddha. And this confirms the existence of the 10 realms in the realm of Sravaka, the realm of learning. Shariputra is a personage of that realm of learning. Remember, I'm always talking about personages, and I'll remind you at this point, threefoldlotus.com. If you go to the core study materials page, you'll see a button near the top that says Personages of the Gohonzon, or Gohonzon Personages. I forget how it's labeled. And that will take you to a teaching Gohonzon, or mandala, and identify numerically all of the characterizations, the personages contained in the mandala. And you can read a great history of all of these different types of personages by Michael McCormick, who did a wonderful job of talking about all these personages. So you can go there, you can download it, you can print it out. Anyway, to move on. The second chapter states that those monks and nuns who sought emancipation through the way of Pratyekabuddha, the way of realization, often equated with Hinayana teachings becoming an arhat, right? Without guidance of teachers, by observing the principle of cause and effect, press their hands together in respect, wishing to hear the perfect way. This affirms the existence of the 10 realms in the realm of Pratyekabuddha, which is not Hinayana, this is Mahayana. It is written in the 21st chapter, and we'll talk about that more. It is written in the 21st chapter, the supernatural powers of the Tathagata, that bodhisattvas as numerous as particles of dust of 1,000 worlds. There's that concreteness again, the word worlds, right? You think earth, planet. Who had sprung up from underground, you and I, beseeched the Buddha for this true, pure, and great Dharma, namely Myoho Renge Kyo. That's our advent. That's why we're here. That's why this is our time. This is our capacity. This is the latter day of degeneration for you and I who have sprung up from the earth. In other words, we are the future who have manifested. And our practice, being a bodhisattva practice, is a practice of beseeching the Buddha for this true, pure, and great Dharma, namely the Myoho Renge Kyo, the Lotus Sutra. This verifies the existence of the 10 realms in the realm of bodhisattvas. Finally, in the 16th chapter, the Buddha sometimes appears as a Buddha in the realm of Buddhas, but at other times appears as some of the others who reside in the other 9 realms. This indicates that the 10 realms are included in the realm of Buddhas. So they're all interpenetrating, right? Which results in 100 realms, because they're all colored together. There's no one resting spot where I'm in the world of Nin. I'm in the world of hunger because I'm insatiable. If you're in the world of hunger, of insatiability, I guarantee you, you're also feeling the hell of that hunger and the wanting to take away from somebody else just for your own gain, animality and anger in your hunger. You're never in just one realm. This is a division in Buddhism to illustrate the incalculable amount of choices and decision-making within the mind that are always available to us in every single moment and are influenced and influence each other constantly. And how do we grapple with this amazingly huge mess, if you will? How do we turn it productive? Answer, Buddha. Because Buddha takes that whole mess and goes, takes it out of play and observes it. And by observing it goes, yeah, I know why you're crying. I know why you don't need to do all those things. Those are impositions you're putting on yourself. That's your karma, your tendencies and your conditions simply manifesting. If you'll let go of what those are, those adherences of this physicality are causing to manifest, then you can experience all of the same things without that binder, without that stress. Then the world becomes an amazing place of abundant choices, none of which bring you down, cause you suffering. And isn't that the whole point of Buddhist practice? Question. We got time to do another one? Yeah. Sorry, a little long in the tooth. When we look at our own faces reflected in a mirror or faces of other people, we can see that our 6 sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, exist. Except that we only see our mind by virtue of experiencing it. So it's a little... However, we cannot see the existence of the ten realms in our own mind and in others'. How can we believe this? Well, I think after this discussion so far, you can see how we certainly can see those ten realms and the ten within the ten and the hundred realms and so on and so forth. Little thing called meditation. In other words, observe the darn mind and you'll be convinced that this drama is constantly ongoing. But let's just take it as read. Somebody asked this questions and they're saying, obviously from a physical perspective, although I question the mind thing, we see our tongues, our eyes, and everything in a mirror, right? But we can't see those realms physically. Well, no, because they're mental. So here's the answer. Certainly. Duh. It is not easy to believe in their existence. In other words, believe in their existence as some qualifiable labeling little box thing, because that's what we love to do in our thinking mind, our samsaric mind. But nevertheless, we can't deny we're experiencing things, right? Buddhism is an experiential science. You can't put it under a microscope. The microscope is your own mind. It is said in the 10th chapter of the Lotus Sutra, the Myoho Rengekyo, the teacher of the Dharma chapter, that the sutra is most difficult to put conviction in and most difficult to comprehend. The 11th chapter, beholding the stupa of treasures or the treasure tower, right? The locus, the apparatus of reward, of enlightenment itself. Also, you might know from previous videos that we've talked about that this is the concept of the mandala, the Namu Myoho Rengekyo down the center of that mandala, that it represents our Gohonzon. Oh, so guess what? Gohonzon, as it is the portal to our Buddha-ness, is the treasure tower. You are the treasure tower. So when you read Beholding the Stupa of Treasures, what are you reading? You're reading an expedient means from Shakyamuni Buddha on how you can instantiate Buddha-ness. That is what beholding the treasure tower is. Yeah? Preaches the 6 difficult and 9 easier actions, maintaining that keeping conviction in the Lotus Sutra, Myoho Rengekyo, after the death of Shakyamuni Buddha is harder than trying to grasp Mount Sumeru and hurl it over countless Buddha lands. So there's this constant back and forth between the mental conceptual experience and the physical conceptual experience. You see the back and forth? According to Grandmaster Tendai, quote, the Lotus Sutra is hard to have conviction in and hard to understand because what is preached in both the essential and theoretical sections of the sutra is altogether different from what is preached in those sutras expounded before the Lotus Sutra. And why is that? Because those preachings before the Lotus Sutra were provisional. They were taught for the capacity of the listeners, the students. And the Lotus Sutra is taught from a perspective of, this is how I did it. You can do as I have done. From my perspective, this is what this method of enlightenment is. We've talked about that before too. Grandmaster Chang'an, the great student of Tendai, quote, the doctrine of mutual possession of 10 realms, Jikai Goku, is the very reason why the Buddha appeared in the world. How can we ordinary people be expected to put resolve in the Lotus Sutra and comprehend it easily? It's going to take effort. Grandmaster Dengyo maintains, quote, this Lotus Sutra, this Myoho Rengekyo, is most difficult to believe and comprehend because the sutra preaches the true intent of Buddha. not Shakyamuni, but Shakyamuni's embodiment of Buddha-ness. All we want to do in our clarity of mind, in our Buddha-ness, is assist others to do the same. Come join me in this wonderful, amazing thought space, this perceptive reality that is far beyond your daily survival, right? After all, those with capacity to understand and have full conviction in Buddhism, who had the luck of listening to Shakyamuni Buddha preach the Myoho Rengekyo in India, called then Sadharma Pudarika, right? Sutram. Oh, sorry, I lost my place. Preached the Lotus Sutra in India, must have accumulated a great deal of merit in their past lives. Again, past lives, future lives, moment to moment to moment, birth death. So in the past, they must have done a great amount of effort in order to enlighten themselves, to even have the opportunity to learn from a master of Buddha-ness, Shakyamuni, the first to have fully realized this mind state, right? Moreover, they were fortunate to have been assisted and guided by the Lord Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha of many treasures, who had come to verify the truth of Shakyamuni's words, various Buddhas in manifestation, who had come from all over the universe, the entirety of it, numerous bodhisattvas who had sprung up from the underground, future students and practitioners of the Buddha way, and such distinguished disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha as Manjushri and Maitreya. And again, I refer you to the personages, right? Because it is very clear here to me, once you understand the personages, that he says they were fortunate to be assisted and guided by Lord Shakyamuni Buddha, Shakyamuni being a man who had attained this enlightenment, but also the Buddha of many treasures who had come to verify the truth of Shakyamuni's words. Come from where? From Shakyamuni's own teachings. Buddha verifying Buddha, a personage, a mental state shared by others. Various Buddhas in manifestation as people attained this Buddha state as students of Shakyamuni Buddha, they too, in their Buddha mind state, would validate the teaching. It's very straightforward. It may sound mystical, but it is not. Who had come up, come from all over the universe. Do you know any friend of yours that comes from Pluto or some star 10 billion light years away? Because Buddha is universal. Buddha is time space. It is the perception of time space as it truly is. And therefore, it has no location. It is only, if you want to give it a location, you could say the mind, but that's not really a location either. It's an experience of it. You follow? I know this is a little bit mind-bending. It twists your melon, right? But it's important that you understand that this process of life is what we're wanting to experience. We're not trying to experience this bookmark. We're not trying to experience a pen, a person. Well, we're transcending that samsaric reality, and we're experiencing the engine of all of that, of all of this. The engine of life, the universe. Nevertheless, there were some who were not converted to Myoho Rengekyo. This is the reason why the self-conceited, as many as 5,000, walked out when the Buddha was about to start preaching in chapter 2, Expedience, and why some men and gods were transferred to other worlds in chapter 11, beholding the stupa of treasures. It was so even when Shakyamuni Buddha was alive. How much more difficult is it to believe in the Lotus Sutra in the ages of true Dharma and semblance Dharma after the death of Shakyamuni Buddha, not to say in the beginning of the latter age of degeneration where you and I are. If you could easily believe the sutra, it would mean that the sutra is not the true Dharma. It's when you're dealing with fundamental truth from the perspective of a samsaric being, no less, it's unfathomable. It's a constant effort to remind oneself. This is why Buddhism is a lifelong practice, because it is something we have to work at maintaining, evolving, growing, maintaining over overruling in a way the samsaric tendencies and conditions of karma. That's what we're going to end our video on today. So yeah, on the one hand, because it's this age of degeneration, we need the most simple, direct way of invoking our Buddha-ness. Because if it were any more complicated, we'd give up. We just wouldn't tolerate it. And if you're studying earlier provisional teachings, what you're going to be reading about are people's assistance in their mind states, trying to get them to the point where they start to understand the concepts of the Lotus Sutra, but they're not there yet. So it's going to look like you have to live 16 million eons of lifetimes before you can attain Buddhahood. Or that if you can just stop having desires about everything, that's good enough. Hinayana, right? An arhat. But you're not there yet. Until you study the Lotus Sutra and you understand, experience that unfathomable truth that you can actually experience, all of these other ideas are distractions that in the age of degeneration is incomprehensible. The amount of mimetics, right? Fake news, alternate truths. I mean, we're barraged by a sea of information and we can't trust anything anymore. We can't believe what we see in our own face, because everything is just a moment to moment. If I say it, I'm doing it. And in the next moment, if it's done, then I'll say something else. We're like racing toward figuring out what in the hell we're doing on this planet for ourselves. We do a very kind thing, followed immediately by a very horrendous thing. We're completely out of control. We're careening through the universe, through time, space, just waiting to run into something so we can react. It's a sad state of affairs. It's no wonder our world is in such disarray today. There's no consistency. Well, the consistency is inconsistency. So if we're going to try to realign our minds to a condition of deep appreciation and consistency, whether you want to call that love or enlightenment or words, they can be useful, but they're just fingers pointing. We want to experience the enlightenment. We need a powerful tool. And Nietzsche knew this. He was living in medieval Japan, surrounded by killers and murderers, and the rule of the day was you live or die by what you utter and your behavior, and you better be towing the line that the elite believe, or you're of no use to us. We'll just take all your crap. We'll behead you. We'll turn your wife into a concubine. It's not even a decision making. There's no trial. Right? He thought, we need something unsullied, uninfluenced, something that doesn't indicate some worldly thing. So he made a mandala that was based on the teachings, the personages, the concepts of the Lotus Sutra. Not an image of someone or some personality, because we don't follow the person, we follow the law. What is the law? Oh, it's right down the middle of the mandala. Namu, I am present. Namu, I am singularly minded, going to manifest Buddha. Mu, I'm going to manifest what? Myoho Rengekyo. The concepts contained within this ultimate teaching, which are built on the entirety of Shakyamuni's teaching. Namo Myoho Rengekyo. Oh, I can do that. Get a mandala, object of focus, and bring about your Gohonzon. Enter the gate, Buddha-ness. Yeah? All right, that's enough for today. That's a lot for today. Thank you. Thank you for participating. Please like, please subscribe. And if there were aspects of this talk today that you can use to help you in influencing someone else, share this video by all means. And on that note, download the audio podcast so you can listen to it and discuss it with your friends or just for yourself, whatever. And that's why we have threefoldlotus.com, so you can print out plenty of documentation to help assist your study, to remember, to get thoughts and words in order so that you can communicate this practice. The bookstore, the mandala store. Yeah. That's what this resource is for. Our Sangha. Let's continue to grow it. Thank you for all your hard work. Those of you who are donating funds, you're absolutely essential for this channel to grow. Thank you. And I will see you in the next one. Promise. Okay. You have a great day. Take care of your health. Be kind to yourself and others, of course. Namo Myoho Rengekyo. Bye for now.